calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius Satellite Radio, on CRN Digital, RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, and on AirAmericaRadio.com. Welcome back to our program. It is Friday. It's the last day of the week. It's the day when the first hour of our program is always devoted to Brunch with Bernie, Congressman Bernie Sanders, the only independent member of the House of Representatives. I think of him as America's congressman. He literally is the only independent member of the House of Representatives, neither Democrat nor Republican. Bernie has been reelected 7 times, the longest-serving independent member of the House in the history of the House of Representatives. His website, bernie.house.gov or bernie.org, which is the best website for him. You'll find a link to it also off our home website, our main website, tomhartman.com, and you can get there as well. It goes right to bernie.org, great website. Congressman Bernie Sanders, welcome to our program, Bernie.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you here. And let me let our listeners know, by the way, we have a new phone number because our program is now being mixed in New York rather than here in Portland, Oregon. And so our new toll-free number, 1-866-440-THOM. 1-866-440-THOM, as in 440-TOM. So, Bernie, a lot in the news, an enormous amount of stuff in the news this week. What's on your list?
Well, I will talk to you about something that really is not on the front pages, and I think it's important. There was a study recently done by the IRS analyzing tax returns. What they concluded, Tom, incredibly enough, is that 99% of taxpayers in the United States had incomes last year below the inflation rate. In other words, people are losing ground. Needless to say, the only people who did well are the top 1%, and within the top 1%, the people who really did well, surprise, surprise, are the top 0.1%. And at the end of the day, according to this report, the wealthiest 0.1% of our taxpayers, very richest people in America, earned more income than the bottom 1/3 of American taxpayers. Got that?
Yeah, it would be interesting to break that down and find out how many minutes it took for that the average person in that top 0.1% to make an amount of money equal to the average annual salary of the bottom 90%.
That's right.
Somebody should do that math. That's the kind of statistic that would really pop people's eyeballs, I suspect.
But the issue, I mean, you're right that there are a zillion issues out there. We've got the Supreme Court, we got the energy bill, we've got gas, the high prices of gas, and the ripoff on the part of the oil companies.
Karl Rove but being indicted.
Karl Rove. I mean, on and on it goes. But from my perspective, if we are going to engage the American people and working people and low-income people in the political process, it is absolutely imperative that we talk about issues that are relevant to their lives. To ask why, with the explosion of technology, with the increase in worker productivity, the average worker today is working longer hours for lower wages. Why is it that unless we change our economic policies, our kids and grandchildren will likely have a lower standard of living than we have? And why is it that we tolerate this growing gap between the rich and the poor? Last year, CEOs of the major Fortune 500 corporations had a 54% increase in their compensation, while working people are falling further and further behind. And with that increase in wealth goes the corollary, an increase in power. So these guys are able to hire more and more lobbyists here in Washington. We're talking here from Washington, D.C. You got these guys making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year representing the oil companies, representing the pharmaceutical companies, representing the insurance companies. So that wealth goes into political power. And then you have folks like Tom DeLay who are very open. Recent Newsweek article, when asked, is it true that you only will talk to people who contribute to the Republican Party? He said, of course. And he was unashamed about it. Why would I want to talk to other people who are not on our side? The idea that you do government for all of the people rather than for large campaign contributors, of course, that's what we do here in Washington right now. So To my mind, what we're seeing now is the collapse of the middle class, 5 million more people entering the ranks of poverty since Bush has been elected. Corporate profits are soaring. Wealthiest people never had it so good. And if we don't wake up and start protecting the middle class, there will not be a middle class in this country, and our kids are going to be living in poverty.
Yeah, well said, and it really is. The folks in our chat room, by the way, right now are just, you know, going nuts right there with you, that these are really the important issues, and everybody is off, you know, whether it's on the totally frivolous stuff of, oh, there's a missing white girl in Aruba, or whether it's the semi-frivolous stuff, you know, what are, I'm not sure it's frivolous, but, you know, Tom DeLay's legal trouble du jour,
right.
Really, as this bread and circus is being played out, the rug is being pulled out from underneath the American
middle
class.
And the end result, and the media, of course, is the corporate media is absolutely complicit. So we'll learn about the young lady in Aruba. We'll learn about some terrible tragedies that strike a family. But what about the tragedies today that are striking millions of American families who can't afford to send their kids to college? People who can't find decent child care for their kids? People who are losing their health insurance? People who see their kids falling further and further behind? Those are the issues that we should be focusing on, not to say that there aren't a lot of other very important issues out there. But I think unless the middle class and working families and lower-income people in America understand the role that government plays in their lives, that it makes a difference whether you elect people who at a time when the oil companies are enjoying record-breaking profits, charging us $3 for a gallon of gas, are getting huge amounts of billions of dollars in corporate welfare, it matters. It matters whether we repeal the estate tax, which is $1 trillion over 20 years to the wealthiest 2%, half of which will go to that very same 0.1%, and yet we don't have enough money to take care of our veterans who are walking into VA hospitals today and are finding themselves on waiting lists, or the young men and women are going to come back from Iraq and Afghanistan and can't get the treatment that they need. What you have right now is a bunch of people in control of this government who work night and day and night and day for the wealthiest people, for the large corporations, for the people who contribute to their campaigns, and they are turning their backs on the vast majority of the people in this country. We've got to get into that process. And we've got to develop public policy that works for everybody and not just the super rich.
To what extent, Bernie Sanders, do you think that the problem that we're facing and that we're seeing writ large in the newspaper stories and writ small in things like what you're talking about here is the function of corrupt folks like Tom DeLay being elected to public office, and people, you know, making one promise and then doing something entirely different, as George Bush has done over and over, or systemic problems, that is the K Street problem that you mentioned,
mm-hmm.
that there is so much money floating around in Washington, D.C., it draws corrupt people like honey draws flies.
Right. I think it's more a systemic problem. If you need huge amounts of money to get elected, to stay in power, then you go to the people who have the money. Now, Tom DeLay is more overt and may well have crossed some legal lines, and we'll find out about that. But the fact of the matter is, for many years, and increasingly now, the legislation that gets onto the floor of the House is more and more legislation which was literally, Tom, I'm not talking figuratively, literally written by lobbyists representing special interests. For example, I mean, this disastrous prescription drug Medicare bill, which is about to go into implementation now, was written by the pharmaceutical industry. The fellow who was the lead author of it was then the chairman of the House Commerce Committee, a fellow named Billy Towson of Louisiana. I'm sure the listeners will be absolutely shocked to find that after Towson resigned from Congress, guess where he ended up working at $2 million a year? Well, shock of all shocks, it was for Pharma, the trade group representing the pharmaceutical industry. He wrote this particular bill, which, among other things, prohibits the government from negotiating prices with the drug companies.
And what's so amazing to me is that, okay, he's getting $2 million a year. That seems like a lot of money to people like you and me who, you know, I mean, that's an enormous amount of money.
Right.
Yet it's chump change for the pharmaceutical companies who are making hundreds of billions of dollars a year in profits.
Tom, that is exactly the point. You know, many people say, oh, my goodness, look, here's this amount of money. When we're talking about the pharmaceutical industry, they have spent hundreds of millions of dollars in lobbying and advertising in order to prevent legislation which would lower the cost of prescription drugs in order to prevent a strong prescription drug Medicare bill for our seniors. And for them, you're right, this is chump change because they make huge, huge, huge amounts in profits. In terms of tax breaks, just the repeal of the estate tax alone, which only applies to the wealthiest 2%, that's $1 trillion over 20 years. That's real money.
That's very real money. It absolutely is. We're talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders. Our telephone number, 866-440-THOM. If you'd like to speak with Congressman Sanders, 866-440-TOM, T-H-O-M. Tom Hartman here with you. We'll be right back.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Your swift boat liars, you would carry. Who risked his life while you withdrew? And now you're putting kids in harm's way. Does your conscience bother you? Tell the truth.
AWOL in Alabama. Welcome back, my friends. 21 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us, as he is the last day of the week, every single week. And so glad to have you back with us. And Congressman Sanders as well, great to have you here. So let's go to the telephone lines here and see what folks have to say. Hey, Bernie?
Okay.
Let's see here. Steve in Allentown, Pennsylvania. Steve, you're live with Congressman Sanders.
Hey, how you doing, Congressman?
Good, Steve.
How you doing, Tom?
Great. What's up?
Okay, my point is, I agree with you about the estate tax to a point. I think they should fix it, not get rid of it, and nobody has to pay 50 cents.
Well, this is what I think. I think I can live, if one can make the case that, in fact, we're protecting small family-owned businesses, I can live with that, and I think that that makes sense. But what you have to appreciate, Steve, half of these benefits are going to the richest one-tenth of 1%. At a time when we have an $8 trillion deficit and the gap between the rich and the poor is already going wider, getting wider, and they want to cut back on a lot of programs for working families, you don't give huge tax breaks to wealthy people. So we can modify it. We can make some changes. I agree with you. But I don't think you go forward with what the president wants.
1-866-440-THOM, 1-866-440-TOM, T-H-O-M. Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the line. You're live with Congressman Sanders, Rick. Rick?
I know you're a legal prognosticator, but these legal problems that Republicans and Congress are having, and Bill Frist and Carl, we're not getting a mixed minus.
His nominee being trashed somewhat by conservatives. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Yeah.
I'm getting bad feedback on my line. Anyway, I just wondered if you think this might lead to a big victory for the Democrats in 2006.
Well, I think a combination of factors. I think the fact that the middle class is shrinking, poverty is growing. I think the fact that it increasingly looks like Bush does not know how to get us out of Iraq. More and more people are lacking health insurance. And with all of these legal problems that, as you indicate, that DeLay is having, that Frist is having, that Karl Rove may be having, yeah, I mean, I think what the polls seem to suggest is that people are not looking terribly favorably upon the president and the Republican Party. The real question is whether the Democrats can come up with a program that makes the American people look up and say, yeah, that's where we want to go. But right now, I think the Republicans are in trouble.
Yeah, okay. Joe in Tacoma, Washington. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM, 440-TOM. And Joe, we're trying out a new system here. Just say a couple words, and I want to make sure Bernie can hear you.
Check, check, check.
Okay, Bernie, could you hear Joe?
I got Joe fine.
Okay, great. Joe,
it
fire away.
It does sound a little hollow.
Yeah.
I'm sitting here watching the House and the Senate debate on the various things that they're passing today. And I asked your producer, he wanted me to make it like concise, and it's so hard because you're looking at these Republicans and they have run amok with the way that they're, what they're doing to New Orleans and Louisiana, and taking money away from the schools, from the public schools, making them have to pay back the loans that they've never done in any other state. Across the board, every time they come up with one of their slogans for some magnificent thing they're going to do for the society, it's like raping them.
That's
and
right.
I'm wondering, what can you do? Even though you're in a body of Congress, how can you do anything with that? Are you frustrated to death?
Well, Joe, we do the best. You know, we're in the minority, and we do the best that we can do. And I think what we can do right now is fight and win occasionally some small victories. But mostly we have to keep the opposition up and expose these Republicans to the entire country and make it very clear that not only did they handle Katrina in an absolutely outrageous way, which led to the death of people who should not have died, but what we're talking about is no-bid contracts going to some of their campaign contributors. You're talking about an administration and a Republican leadership that, by and large, are in the pockets of big money interest, and we got to keep pounding away at that. And I think the word, in fact, is getting through, and the American people are catching on. But is it frustrating? You bet it is. And it's frustrating because there is so much that we can do in providing health care to all people, in stopping the loss of decent-paying jobs going to China. And yet we see time and time again this administration and leadership coming down on the side of the wealthy and the powerful against the needs of working families.
Ron in Davis, California, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, Ed, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead, Ron. Just speak up.
Yeah, I don't have time, but my thing is, I'm an old-time radical. I'm probably about your age or Bernie's age, something like that. Went through the 60s and learned how to do deep research. And most Americans rely on television and newspapers, and plus with the overwhelming Republican power, we're dealing in, as far as I can tell, a soft fascist state. Now, my issue is, one of the few remaining ways we might be able to grab some power back, other than waiting around until 2008, is to look at class and differentiate, actually, between the working class and the middle class. Somebody who works at Walmart is not middle class.
Good point, Ron, and we'll get Congressman Sanders' response to that right after this break. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment on the Tom Hartman radio program. Our number, 866-440-THOM. We'll be back right after this, 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here, along with Congressman Bernie Sanders. Our Brunch with Bernie segment, the last day of every week, our Brunch with Bernie segment. For more information about what Bernie Sanders is up to, about his campaign, about the information we talk about on this program, an enormous information resource, check out Bernie.org, www.Bernie, B-E-R-N-I-E.org, for more information. Back to the telephone lines, our number 1-866.
We had a phone call from Ron. You remember that?
Yeah, that's right. Thank you, Bernie. You're so good at keeping me on track. Go for it.
That we should differentiate between the middle class and the working class. And that's an important point to make. But I think the more important point is that in today's economy, not only is the working class, especially people who don't have a college education and young people, not only are their incomes being decimated, not only are their jobs, manufacturing, blue-collar jobs, heading to China, but the middle class is in serious trouble as well. Because what we're seeing now is white-collar information technology jobs heading to India, heading to China, heading elsewhere as well. So to my mind, the real economic focus should be what is happening to the vast majority of the people. And at the beginning of the show, I mentioned 99% of the people saw a decline in their income last year. Taxpayers saw a decline in their income. Only the wealthiest people did well. And I think we got to focus on that.
Yeah, and that's, as George Bush says, you know, here I am among the haves and the have-mores. Some people call you the elite, I call you my base. I mean, he wasn't joking.
And he has done, we got to give him credit. He has kept his word to the richest people in this country. They are doing great.
Yeah. Phil in Tampa, Florida, you're on live with Congressman Bernie Sanders. What's up, Phil?
Hi. I want to ask him a question about this investigation of Representative Duke Cunningham. He is living in in a place where I used to live, and he's living in the most expensive part of San Diego County, where an entry-level home is about $2.5 million. I don't know how you afford that on a $100-and-some-thousand-dollar salary.
The he you're talking about is Duke Cunningham.
San Diego, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Apparently, a federal judge, probably a good Republican conservative judge, ordered recently that the proceeds from the sale, his house sale, because he's selling a house that he bought with illegal money, apparently, is to be paid in an escrow account. And it looks like basically he bought this home with a bribe from a DOD contractor. And it looks like, the conservative judge and the conservative prosecutor are going to sweep this under the conservative rug to take care of this guy. The same way his son, who imported 2 tons of marijuana in a plane into a little airport in Connecticut, got off for, I think he served less than a year in prison or jail because his daddy came to court and cried. And, of course, it was a good old conservative judge who overlooked the sentencing guidelines.
So Phil, what's your question for Bernie?
Little boy.
Well, Phil, I can't.
I want to know why. What do you think this is going to happen here?
Well, Phil, I can't speculate. We're in the courts. There are very strong allegations made against Cunningham. I think the FBI has raided his premise, and you got to let the legal process work out. It would be improper for me to comment on it, because I don't know a whole lot more than I read in the papers.
Okay, is it Edie or Eddie in Kirkland, Washington?
It's Edie, Tom.
Edie, hey Edie, you're live with Congressman Sanders.
Hi, thank you. I would like to ask if you would ask your listeners to please call the House of Representatives and ask them to support Senator Landrieu on her bill to get some emergency funding to the Gulf Coast for their vital services. She's not asking for much. She's been on the floor of the Senate for 24 hours all night long begging in between the $445 billion defense bill to just get $1 billion from FEMA that's already been appropriated to have these cities be able to pay their workers.
So you want people to call their senator?
Well,
senators.
It's left the Senate. It's on its way over to the House.
Oh, it's on its way over to the House. Okay. How's that going to be handled?
I think Edie makes a very, very good point. But we want to see it. I mean, people are suffering so much. We want to see real help get into the hands of real people, not get stifled by the bureaucracy.
Steve in Atlanta, Georgia, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Hey, Tommy. Bernie. It's an honor to talk to you, Mr. Sanders. I've got a question about the upcoming election 2006 for the Democratic candidates. You know, it seems when they're going to be debating the Republican incumbents that, you know, it's very easy to look at the bills that have been passed and those problems, you know, like the appropriation bills, the energy bills, and the endangered species bills and other environmental bills. But wouldn't it be as effective to point out the bills that have been suppressed by the Republican-controlled committees? And I found it's very difficult to find these, and I wonder if you have any resources you know of.
Sure. You can. There is a very good website for the U.S. Congress which lists every bill in detail introduced by members of Congress. So if you know your member, you can find it. It's part of the Thomas website system, and you can get all the information you need. But Steve's point is a good point. Every listener has got to understand that a few people, i.e. the leadership of the Republican Party, determines what bills get to the floor of the House. So it's not just that the bills that are coming onto the floor are anti-environment or pro-corporate or pro-wealthy people bills. It's that a lot of good pieces of legislation will never get out of committee because they threaten special interests. That's a very important point to remember.
And another reason why it's important to break Republican control of both the House and the
Absolutely.
Senate.
Absolutely. Many people don't understand how the system works, and that is that the dominant party, whether it's Republican or Democrat, appoints every committee chairperson. So the Republicans control every single committee, and unless those chairpeople allow stuff to get onto the floor of the House, it doesn't get onto the floor of the House. That's why we haven't seen any legislation to raise the minimum wage, any legislation to provide health care to all people, any serious legislation to move us away from fossil fuel to sustainable energy, why we have seen disaster after disaster after disastrous piece of legislation coming on the floor.
And at least to their credit, correct me if I'm wrong, Bernie, when the Democrats controlled the House of Representatives, they allowed onto the floor bills that they opposed.
That They did it a lot more.
With some regularity.
Than the Republicans do. The Republicans moaned and groaned that they didn't have as much opportunity as they wanted. Compared to what the Democrats gave them, the Republicans have been extremely harsh about making sure that alternative pieces of legislation does not get to the floor of the House. And the other issue related to that is the whole idea of oversight, the role of the U.S. Congress in monitoring what goes on in the administration. When Clinton was president, as everybody will remember, there were hearings almost every single day about everything that Clinton did. Meanwhile, in terms of Bush, the Republican Party has thrown in the towel and said, Mr. President, you could do whatever you want, and we are not going to hold hearings, we're not going to hold investigations. And this is a very serious problem for the whole future of American democracy and separation of powers.
There you go. Doug in Seattle, Washington, you're live with Congressman Sanders.
Good afternoon, or good morning, Tom. Good afternoon, Senator, or Congressman, it's an honor.
Nice to talk to you, Doug.
It's a long day. Actually, somebody else already mentioned it, but my question was the defense bill, that $445 billion defense bill that in the Senate had the interrogation language put in it and what standards we should accept. The president has said he will veto the entire bill because of that language, and it's going into committee now since the House passed their version. Is there any chance that it's going to go through committee as intact and the president will be held up for the true hypocrite and liar that he is?
And Bernie, if I can just toss into that, isn't the essence of that rider simply, doesn't it simply say that the Army has to conform to the standards in their own manual, which have been there since World War II?
That is my understanding, Tom. And I think here's an example where the Republican leadership, or at least the majority of the members, did something right. It is very rare, but we have to give them credit. And that is, they understand that if the United States engages in torture, A, it threatens our own soldiers who could be treated similarly, and B, it tarnishes our reputation internationally. So I applaud the Republicans in this instance for doing what they very rarely do, and that is stand up to the president. And I hope very much that we can keep that language in the final bill.
John in Chicago, Illinois, you're live with Congressman Sanders.
Yeah, hello. Good afternoon, guys. I was listening to earlier when you were talking about the middle class, you know, declining, and I called to make a comment about that because in Chicago, there almost is no more middle class. You're either upper or in poverty.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, I think that that's going to play out differently in different parts of the country, but the reality is that the gap between the rich and the poor is certainly growing wider. In the last 5 years under Bush, 5 million more people have entered the ranks of the poor. People in the middle class who are barely hanging on are either losing their health insurance or paying far more than they can afford. The $3 per gallon of gas has taken a lot of people over the edge. So, I guess it plays out differently in different parts of the country, but there's no question that we are moving in the way of many of these Latin American countries. We have a tiny handful of people at the top, huge numbers of people living in poverty, and a real struggling middle class.
Yeah, we're seeing the gentrification of so many cities here, where it's just you have to be very wealthy to live. Bob in Seattle, Washington, we only have about a minute left. A quick question?
Yeah, Tom or Bernie, I want to know, with the new Supreme Court nominees, is there a chance they could change labor laws to affect us? Could they stock debtor prisons, or what's the worst they could do to us for working people?
Well, that's a question that needs a lot more than a minute. I think, in essence, the fear is not only the rollback of Roe versus Wade, but also redefining the proper role of the government in general in protecting the needs of the middle class and working families through a whole bunch of legislation, i.e. suggesting that standing up for working people is taking away constitutional rights from corporations and wealthy people. That's an area that concerns me very much.
It's a terrible problem. And you can get into that a little more when we come back if you wish.
Sure.
It's the pill that will help you escape the matrix, the Tom Hartman radio program. Speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone here in the People's Republic of Portland, Oregon. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Come together right now. Over me.
And welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes, more or less, before the top of the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. And, Bernie, you were talking about the impact of the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court nominee. I'm just curious if you have, in addition to your thoughts on that, if you have an opinion yet on Edith, on the new nominee that George Bush
Only the sense that here he is being charged with cronyism, and he appoints a lawyer who is loyal to him, rather than somebody who is well-versed in the law, who has a track record, who has a history. So I am suspicious about that. But the truth is that folks don't know a whole lot about her legal views, and that makes me quite nervous. Getting back to Bob's question, I think the issue of what the Supreme Court could do is, you remember, Tom, that in the 1920s, 1930s, there were many employers, the big business guys, who were saying, it is unconstitutional for workers to form a union. I can fire them. They don't have that right.
Right.
If they don't want to work here, it is unconstitutional to have a minimum wage. I will pay people anything I want. And
right.
Those are the kinds of issues, the proper role of government in protecting working people, protecting the environment. If I own a factory and I want to spew garbage into the air or crap into a lake or into a river, I have the right to do it. It's my property. How dare the government?
Yeah, they said that a strict interpretation of the Constitution means, because the Constitution doesn't allow for things like minimum wage or worker protections or unions, therefore you can't have those things.
That's
and that's
right.
How the court was ruling back in the teens and 20s.
Exactly. So to answer Bob's question, those are the kinds of fears that some of us have.
Richard in Hendersonville, North Carolina. Richard, you're live with Congressman Sanders.
Hey, Bernie. Great to talk to you. God bless you. I think you're doing a great job, and I can... hope you've been added to my list, man. I say God bless Bernie every night.
Thank you, Bernie.
The avian flu represents a tremendous threat to the health and well-being of ordinary American citizens. I don't really think that our government and our country is even getting close to prepared. Is there anything that Congress can do to facilitate something along these lines, a little more of a comprehensive approach?
And let me add to that, Bernie. George Bush has said that his response would be to call out the military. You know, what about posse comitatus, and is that the right response?
Well, that's good, too. But Richard raises a very good point that I think Bush has been slow to acknowledge the severity of the problem, and I think the last couple of days he has. I read a book called Influenza on the 1919 flu pandemic, which killed some 50 million people. Internationally. So we have got to recognize that this is a potential disaster. We have got to work to make sure that vaccines are available to people in the United States and throughout the world. We have got to do everything we can to control it. And as Richard indicated, we need a comprehensive approach. The good news, Richard, is that in the Senate just the other day, they appropriated $4 billion to begin dealing with this issue. So that's, I think we're starting late, but at least there is an acknowledgement of the potential severity of this problem.
That's great. Dan in Watertown, New York. Dan, you're live with Congressman Sanders.
Yeah, good afternoon, gentlemen. I appreciate what the congressman and a few others like himself are doing, but I think they're missing a cogent point in this whole matter about the neocon Republicans is their malicious attempt in their policies and procedures and what they're doing to the country. I'm not one to mince words, really. I think they're the scum of the earth. And I'm worried about the 2006 elections and all the voter fraud. I think they've got it down pat now where they're going to keep stealing elections. I wonder if the congressman would address that.
Bernie?
Thanks, Dan. I mean, this is a question that Tom and I and listeners have talked about many, many, many times.
For a couple of years now.
Yeah, and I know Tom has written about this issue. And I think all that I can say is that we have to be absolutely vigilant to make certain that every vote cast in America is accurately counted. We have to be vigilant to make sure that every eligible America is entitled to vote, is not intimidated. And we have to be vigilant to make sure that people don't have to wait online for hours and therefore get discouraged from voting. We have to put pressure not only here in Washington, where some of us are doing the best we can, but with our Secretary of States and with our state legislatures as well. It is a huge issue, and we've got to be vigilant.
Mary in Fredericksburg, Virginia, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi,
Congressman. I have a question to ask. With the American people becoming more dissatisfied with the situation in Iraq and more American servicemen are dying, especially this week, do you feel that there is a link between the so-called threat of the New York subway system, do you feel it's to cause the American people to be afraid and let Bush keep going the course? I mean, the newspaper that I read today states that we're now up to $560 billion on this war.
No, that sounds too high. We're not up that high. But
okay.
Mary raises a question that a lot of people are raising, and that is it seems that when Bush goes down in the polls, there are efforts to try to make the American people more fearful.
And in fact, Tom Ridge, after he left his job, came out and said, USA Today reported it, that many of the terror alerts that happened during the campaign, like during the DNC meetings, he didn't order, and he couldn't figure out why the White House wanted them.
The answer is, all that I can say is, terrorism is serious business. We know what happened in London a couple of months ago. We've got to be absolutely vigilant. There are people out there who would attack a subway and so forth and so on. On the other hand, what we also have to understand is we have people in the White House who I think are prepared to use what tools that they can in order to push their own political well-being. So,
Steve in Marysville, Washington, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hello?
Yeah,
hi.
You're on the air.
Okay, yeah. Good to talk to you guys. My question or point, I'll take the answer off the air, but back during World War II, the Emperor of Japan was told by, I think it was Admiral Yamamoto, that their biggest fear about going up against America was their industrial might. And it appears that we are exporting all our industrial might.
Right. Steve, I got to stop it there and let Bernie respond to that.
Steve has raised a very, very important question that a lot of folks, whether you're progressive or conservative, are worried about, that industry after industry is leaving the United States, heading to China, heading elsewhere, and we are going to be a country that is not producing very many real products. It is a huge issue.
Yeah, the hollowing out of the industrial infrastructure of the United States is not just, I mean, it's good jobs, important, is an important issue. It's a vital issue. But also, we can't make enough stuff to have our own army anymore.
That's right.
Yeah,
very
so.
Important.
Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. His website, Bernie.org. Check it out. Thanks you so much for being with us, Bernie. We'll see you next week.
Okay, Tom.
Congressman Bernie Sanders. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program.
The man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to our program, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast, border to border, as they say. A little later on in the program, this morning I interviewed former Congressman Tim Romer, former 9/11 commissioner, and asked him the question about, what about Building 7? And I'll share that with you a little later on in the program as we go on. First, though, I we'll be taking your calls as time goes on. Our telephone number, 866-440-TOM, T-H-O-M, 440-T-H-O-M. But first, Joyce Riley is with us. Joyce has she's a spokesperson for the American Gulf War Veterans Association. And Joyce, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much, Tom.
You folks are out there, really out there on the leading edge. You've got this. Is it your documentary, Beyond Treason?
It is mine and William Lewis. Yes.
Tell us about this. Beyond Treason? Why that title?
Well, it's time that we call it what it is. When you experiment upon people without their consent, it is beyond treason.
Especially if they're soldiers.
Pardon?
Especially if they're soldiers, people who have stepped up and said, "I'm willing to give my life for my country."
Absolutely. Whether it's civilians or whether it's soldiers, and it has been done on both, it is time that it stop. What I learned when I was in the Air Force was that we were being experimented upon, but only after the damage had been done. And I tell you, when I saw a Senate report, 103-97, that said that over the past 50 years, hundreds of thousands of our military have been experimented upon without their knowledge or consent, I just totally lost it. I could not believe that this had been going on for 50 years with hundreds of thousands of our troops. And you know, in a day and age when everybody wants to put a yellow magnetic made-in-China ribbon on their car that says support the troops and they think they're doing their job, we need to realize that these troops are coming back and they're dying. I just got off the phone just a minute ago with a woman, and it breaks my heart. She was telling me about her brother who just returned from Iraq, two tours in Iraq. He was confused. He was driving down the wrong side of the street, had a seizure, and has no renal failure, no kidney function whatsoever, is in the ICU. And she asked me, could this be depleted uranium poisoning? And I said, those are the symptoms of it. And she just began to scream and to cry. And she said she just cannot believe that we are doing this to our military while they're over there. And the unfortunate part is the experiments are continuing through today.
You, by experiments, we've depleted uranium, you mentioned. What are the other experiments?
Well, we know about Agent Orange now, which was an experiment of different type during the Vietnam War. We know about MK Ultra, Mind Control Ultra, which was a project with 160 sub-projects in the area of mind control and how to create mind control, which was done on military and civilian subjects.
In fact, a friend of mine was going to school at MIT back in the 60s, and he was recruited for that. They gave him LSD and hypnotized him.
And, you know, there was no
follow-up. Amazing.
There was no real research on these people, and there's no telling how many of them died or were affected adversely as a result of these experiments.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, they used 89 colleges and universities around this country that we know of for these experiments. Then we go into something called Operation White Coat, which was the use of Seventh-day Adventist troops, and they put them through Fort Detrick, Maryland testing, and they call it defensive testing or defensive weapons research, but it was really offensive weapons research, and many of those people have become quite ill and died as a result of their exposure to Operation White Coat. So we look at these experiments that have gone on, not to mention the vaccine trials that were experimental. And we don't have any idea how many of those were done because we've just now found information regarding the Tri-Service Vaccine Task Force experiment with wanting to use the West Nile fever virus vaccine, which, if you remember back in the 1990s, we never had West Nile virus in this country until it was sold by the Department of Commerce or with the approval of the Department of Commerce and CDC between 1985 and 1989 to Iraq. Then all of a sudden, in 1990, they decide, hey, let's develop a West Nile virus vaccine. We didn't know anything about the problem at the time. You create the problem, they create the solution, and that's what we had. So it's time that we say enough is enough. The use of depleted uranium is destroying the entire area, has already destroyed it for 4.5 billion years. Our military are sick. We have 400,000 out of 700,000 that are sick from the first Gulf War that nobody knows about. And we continue to play this game of we're concerned about disclosing the Abu Ghraib pictures because we care so much about our troops when we have so many of them dying right now before our very eyes, and all they say is, gee, we can't figure it out. It must be a mystery illness.
We're talking with Joyce Riley, a spokesperson for the American Gulf War Veterans Association. Joyce, where can people, how can people see your documentary, Beyond Treason?
Okay, they can go to beyondtreason.com. There's a trailer there. And it will tell you also, if you are a military person, prior military or present military, you can get a copy at no charge. And I do encourage you to do that. You can fax us, and the number is there at beyondtreason.com. If you are not military and you want to see this, and it does come with a CD-ROM with half the size of an encyclopedia worth of documents that they wish that we did not have, I can assure you. It comes with a CD-ROM and a DVD, and it's $20, and you can call 877-GULF-VET, 877-GULF-VET, G-U-L-F-V-E-T. And we do hope that the troops will take advantage of this and get the DVD at no charge.
That's great. And is this going to go into theater release? Is it going to be out there?
We hope so. We don't know. We don't know right now. It's getting a lot of attention. The Department of Defense is not happy at all about this. But you see, I am a nurse who joined the military for the right reasons, like all of us did. And I want to see these troops taken care of, and they're dying in huge numbers. And anybody who is in Iraq right now, I hate to tell you this, but they're being poisoned by this depleted uranium. And it's time that we quit just dancing around the dead elephant in the living room and acknowledge it for what it is. So I just hope that everybody understands that if we do nothing now, our troops are going to come back, and they are going to die.
Not to mention the people of Iraq.
Oh, not to mention, absolutely.
I mean, you've got 35 million people there.
Yes, where we have more babies being born deformed than are normal over there. And unfortunately, that was one editorial decision that I made, was to include some of these pictures just brought back from Iraq, because people need to understand how serious it is. The next seven generations are going to be affected by this. And the reason that we did this documentary is because we couldn't get anyone in Congress or the Senate to do anything about it. They're dragging their feet on it. The use of depleted uranium is now worldwide. I mean, we've done it in Bosnia, Yugoslavia, Afghanistan, Iraq, or at least in the Middle Eastern countries. And we're selling it to 15 different countries. And depleted uranium is all the way from a 7.65 shell all the way up to 50 caliber and the bunker buster bombs. And we have got to stop the use of this because it is destroying this planet.
But it's a very profitable and easy way to get rid of nuclear waste, Joyce.
Bingo.
So,
you're absolutely right.
So what if somebody has a Gulf War veteran in their family, or an Iraq War, or Afghanistan War veteran, or Bosnian War veteran, for that matter, in their family? They come back home, or they've been home for a while, and whether they're perfectly healthy or whether they're starting to show some symptoms that are alarming them, how do they get tested for things like exposure to depleted uranium or to find out if they've had experimental vaccines used on them?
Well, usually they're going to find out because they start developing symptoms. But the way that they can, the best way is urinalysis for depleted uranium. But it's really hard to get it done in this country right now. And there are some other tests that can be done. It costs about $1,000 to really test somebody with a whole body scan, I've been told. And what we're looking at, though, is a massive number of people that are going to require this. In the state of Louisiana and Connecticut, we're the first to say that every troop returning in the Guard, Air National Guard or the National Guard, needs to be tested for depleted uranium. And the Department of Defense said, no, we're not going to test them. So the law is in place to do it. There is no funding from the DOD because they don't want to find what they don't want people to know about. But I will tell you, Tom, that the number of people that I am getting calls from right now is just exorbitant. I mean, it's way over the scale of what people should be coming back with illnesses. I had
people calling you
call
with symptoms.
She's been back 3 months, and on the return trip to the U.S. From her deployment to Iraq, out of the 105 people in her unit, 99 of them were sick. So this is we're not kidding around. The DOD knows full well what's about to take place. The hospitals are full. The military facility hospitals are full. The VA hospitals are full, and they're getting ready for this cover-up of, oh, it sounds like a mental problem to me.
Well, that's what they did with the first Gulf War. Why would they think they can't do it with this Gulf War?
Exactly, exactly. And people bought into it. And these kids that are over there right now, and I call them kids in comparison to me now, they were so young during the first Gulf War, they didn't remember. They were like me when the Vietnam veterans came back, and they were so sick, and I said, oh, yeah, they just want to be taken care of for a lifetime, because I believed the media at the time.
And it was Agent Orange. Among
exactly.
other things, yeah,
exactly.
as well as experimental vaccines. So once again, where people can find information on this, Joyce Riley, spokesperson for the American Gulf War Veterans Association, beyondtreason.com.
Beyondtreason.com. Another really good one for vets is gulfwarvets.com. And I thank you very much, Tom, and I do want to commend you. I've got the Edison gene sitting right here.
Oh, great.
I want to commend you on that book.
Thanks so much. Joyce Riley, spokesperson for the American Gulf War Veterans Association. Check it out, beyondtreason.com. Joyce, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, sir.
We will be back at 16 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the True People's Radio.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
I'm just an old truth teller. I'm your candid friend.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Where being progressive never felt so good. Your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Ellen Ratner's with us with the Talk Radio News Service, our correspondent in Washington, our bureau chief in Washington, D.C. Hey, Ellen, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you so much, Tom. And, you know, I got to tell you, the White House today, they're always on track. They totally denied that the president said to the Palestinians that he got information from God about what to do.
Yeah, this story now being published, all over the world. I mean, so it's all over the place. BBC published it originally, did they not?
Because of a show, they're doing a special, a 2 or 3 part special.
Right, and they interviewed.
I think on the 10th.
Yeah, and they interviewed Abu Mazen or Abbas, the guy who's the leader of the Palestinian now the Palestinian Authority, the soon to be the sovereign state of Palestine, I guess. And Abbas said that George Bush said to him that God told him to invade Iraq, and he did it. God told him to invade Afghanistan, and he did it. And God told him to help a Palestinian state come about, and he was going to do it.
And a little other White House news. They, of course, told the people in New York that they had discovered this information when they raided a house in Iraq. And that they may be under some real problems, although the White House is now saying they're not sure the information was really credible, but they thought it was their duty, since it was specific, to warn New York City. Well, it's very interesting. They have already sent out talking points to people essentially saying, to their right-wing, you know, agenda hosts, essentially saying that this proves why it is important for us to be in Iraq.
Now, yeah, right. May 10th of this year, Ellen Radner, May 10th of this year, the USA Today published an article by Mimi Hall in which, well, I'll just share a couple sentences from it with you. The Bush administration, this is right from the lead, the Bush administration periodically put the USA on high alert for terrorist attacks. Now, this is through 2004 during the election cycle. For high alert for terrorist attacks, even though then Homeland Security Tom Ridge argued there was only flimsy evidence to justify raising the threat level, Ridge now says. Ridge, who resigned February 1st, said Tuesday that he often disagreed with administration officials who wanted to elevate the threat level to orange or high risk of terrorist attack, but was overruled. He said, and I quote, "There are times when some people were really aggressive about raising it, and we said, for what?" End of quote. And then they go on to say the level is raised only if a majority of the president's Homeland Security Council favors it. That's Bush, the attorney general, in this case it was Ashcroft, in this case Gonzalez, the FBI director, the CIA director. I guess they'd be replaced now by the Department of Homeland Security, Mr. Negroponte, and the defense secretary Don Rumsfeld and Secretary of State Condi Rice. So if those four get together and say, well, it's worth scaring people, let's do it. But all through that time, as we were coming up to the election, there's other polls that found every time during the election cycle, every time Bush or the Bush administration declared a terror alert, his rating in the polls over a 48-hour period went up 2.1% on average. And there's a lot of people who are saying, okay, Karl Rove goes before the grand jury. Bush gives a speech in which he doesn't say anything new. He just repeats old lines. Bad news all over the place. The Senate votes 90 to 8 or 9 to say, George, you can't torture people.
And that bill totally passed the Senate this morning.
Right. And all of this is happening yesterday. And so what does the White House do? All right, well, we don't know who did it, actually, but somebody from Homeland Security gets in touch with the Republican mayor of New York City and the Republican governor of New York State. And they're holding press and they just grab the news cycle. I mean, CNN yesterday, 4 solid hours of just cameras watching subways. And nobody talked about Karl Rove. Nobody talked about the torture vote. Nobody talked about the economy melting down. Nobody talked about the 6 dead soldiers in Iraq.
And I want to say something else. The White House, although they are trying to, I agree, throw people off the scent, but it's very interesting. The president is meeting today with the vaccine manufacturers, and lo and behold, one of the things they said is that they wanted to have a capacity to prepare for the flu pandemic, not a possible flu pandemic. They said the flu pandemic. So this is something that they just slipped in there today. But watch what happens to that as well.
Well, everybody in the scientific community has been saying for about a year now, since people first started dying of this in Asia, it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. I mean, it was a bird flu that mutated in 1918 that produced the Spanish flu, the massive flu pandemic of 1918-1919.
So. But what's happening is the White House didn't say, you know, now they are addressing it as a fait accompli, but it certainly has taken them a year.
Yeah, do you think that they actually meant that, or do you think it was the verbal typo?
I actually think he knows that if the flu pandemic hits this country and he has not met with the manufacturers, which he should have done a year ago, and they haven't done what they should have done a year ago, that this is going to be, as he would say, his political capital. It's the final nail on the
on the corner of his political capital, which is down to almost zero anyway.
Yeah, it's like all the stuff adding up for Herbert Hoover. I mean, Herbert Hoover actually ran for re-election in 1932, and his slogan was, "Prosperity is just around the corner." You know, people were like, "Enough already. We don't believe this." Ellen Ratner, our bureau chief in Washington, D.C., with Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Ellen, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Keep up the great work. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where smart people get their news, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a corporation? Is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, nah, don't think so.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
He was a famous trumpet man from our Chicago way. He had a boogie style that no one else could play. He was a top man at his craft. But then his number came up and he was called with a draft. He's in the Army now, a blowing reveille. He's a boogie boogie bugle bar company piece.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Yeah, it's the the boogie woogie bugle boy, only unfortunately he's over there in Iraq with George W. Bush's war, getting irradiated with depleted uranium and vaccines experimented. A lot of sick people coming back. This is a not, as Joyce said, it is not just a tragedy. It's not just a horror. It's not just a crime. It is beyond treason. I spoke with Tim Romer this morning. I do a three-hour morning show for the Clear Channel Station, and a Clear Channel Station in Portland, Oregon, KPOJ, a 25,000-watt station here in the Pacific Northwest. And it's our local kind of morning progressive talk radio. And then I do this national program and out of the same studios. And on that local program this morning, I interviewed Tim Romer. He's in town. He's in Portland here for this big statewide Democratic hoop-de-doop convention of sorts. And I thought, wow, I've got this guy on who was on the 9/11 commission. And, you know, when I was interviewing David Ray Griffin last week, he said the commission in their report never addressed what happened to Building 7. Why did a building which wasn't hit by an airplane and wasn't even, you know, in the same block as the buildings that were hit by an airplane, why did that building collapse? And let me say right up front, I don't know. You know, I don't have a conspiracy theory to lay on you. I would like to know some answers, but I don't know. I just, you know, I got no dog in this fight, as it were, other than, you know, I'm an American and I'd like to know what's going on. So anyhow, I had Tim Romer on and I thought, I'll ask him. So here's our dialogue. Here's our discussion this morning. Tim Romer, you were on the 9/11 commission looking into what happened there in 9/11. And I do a national radio program, and at least once a week, somebody calls into that program and says, you know, the 9/11 commission never did answer the question, what happened to Building 7? Why did a building that wasn't even hit by an airplane collapse on that day in 9/11? And that question is fueling all kinds of conspiracy theories. Did the commission fail to answer that in its report? And if so, why? And if not, you know, what's the answer?
Tom, we tried to do the best job we could on this commission report. 5 Republicans and 5 Democrats. We put out 41 recommendations. We got about half of those through Congress and the White House. The White House and the Congress still aren't passing half of these recommendations, including providing public radio spectrum to our first responders, trying to make sure we're doing something about weapons of mass destruction so Osama bin Laden doesn't get a hold of those and create a Hiroshima-type activity on the United States, which he wants to do. We say on page 116, we picked up intelligence saying that Osama has instructed al-Qaeda to get a bomb and use it on the United States, and Congress and the White House still haven't done one of our 3 recommendations there. We didn't do things perfectly, as you point out, but we did look at Building 7. We did not find evidence that, you know, as the conspiracy theorists, as you said, think there are a host of different plots there. We looked at it. We interviewed people on it. Popular Mechanics did a series of stories on this and saying that it would eventually fell due to you know, problems from the towers and the collapse of the towers and you know, the different building materials coming down from those. So, you know, you're going to hear conspiracy theories, I think, for a long time on anything that the government does. We still hear about Lincoln's assassination and Kennedy's assassination, the Warren Report. We tried to do the best job we could in 2 years, given the White House fighting us most of the way, with access and funding and length. I think we did a very good job. I hope to continue to do a better job on the 9/11 Commission, continue to try to look at the facts and get to the bottom of things as the best of our ability. But the bottom line, Tom, is this. Congress and the White House have a responsibility to protect this country. They're not doing a good enough job on that. They're like sprinters going around a track. They started running around the track to protect the country. They stopped running about halfway around, dropped the baton, and quit the race. We've got a lot going on in America today. The subways in New York, we've got people in hazmat suits in them right now. We're off track on the war on global jihadist terrorism. The president sees everything through Baghdad rather than through a global vision of alliances and partnerships and a balanced political military strategy. And we're still pork barrel spending on homeland security without a strategy. We better get this right soon.
Yeah, great points on all those. Just so the next time I get one of these calls, I can give a straight up answer.
You can give a straight up.
Did you guys
answer.
Respond to Building 7 or not?
We did, and
what did you say?
We found that it collapsed due to structural problems and problems from the collapse of 16 acres of building material, sometimes 7 and 8 stories high all around it, and. If people have other information, you know, Tom, we got, you've probably seen this too. I've seen it on a video on the internet. There are some people that believe that a plane did not hit the Pentagon,
sure.
but a missile hit it.
Yeah.
And we found no evidence of that either. So I think you're going to hear a lot of different theories out there.
Yeah. Well, it was just a great opportunity.
I hope we positively move forward here and protect and better look at how to do this global war on jihadism rather than get sidetracked moving backwards on different conspiracy theories.
Yeah, it is just it's something that's not dying. And I thought, you know, here, I've got a guy from the commission. And
absolutely. Good question.
Thought I would. Yeah, a good question. And I got the distinct impression it was like a good question. Wished you hadn't answered that. So anyway, it's Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-THOM. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-TOM, T-H-O-M. Melissa in Seattle, Washington on the line. Hey, Melissa, welcome to the program.
Hi.
What's up? I can. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay.
I have some comments here, a thought.
Sure.
For instance, the average American doesn't know what we don't have, say, compared to other democracies. We need something like, like the nation ran a 8.5 by 11 sheet comparing what other nations, what other decent governments give their people, and then ask the question, how come we don't have it? Don't we deserve it?
Well, you know, interestingly, I assume you're talking about things like health care and pensions and elder care and a social safety net. At the top of the next hour, we're going to be interviewing the woman who wrote the book, Help Mom, There Are Liberals Under My Bed, which is a children's book about the terrible liberals. In fact, on the cover are Teddy Kennedy and Hillary Clinton.
You talking about that before.
Yeah, and it's an absolutely bizarre but fascinating demonization. It reminds me of the books that were published in Germany in the 30s about Jews. Creating cartoon characters out of people and making them evil. And I think that what you would find is that the conservative answer to what you're saying, and the reason why we don't have this, is because conservatives have been blocking this. I mean, in 1947 was the first time Harry Truman tried to pass national health care, and the Republicans and Democrats had taken control of the Senate in 1946, and they blocked that. Is because conservatives say that if you give people things, even if it's their own tax dollars, even if the people say the majority of us want this, that's socialism and it's bad.
Yeah, I agree with all that. But what I'm getting at is that we're going to be sending people to Washington, some new people, and I want them to go with a clear mandate that's telling them, like, we want decency in government, we want the wicked, evil, and greedy punished, we want our money back, we want our jobs back, and we want these things like other responsible governments give their people.
Yeah.
And what I'm saying is that the average American has no idea about this, but if I had, say, somebody ran an 8.5, 11 fact sheet showing me the difference, that I could run off an ordinary copier. I'd be handing it out to every neighbor.
Well, I'll tell you what, Melissa, pop onto our message board. If you go to tomhartman.com and click the message board blog link, it'll take you to our message board. And start a thread, start a discussion about that. What should be on that brochure? There's some really great minds over there, some really great folks. And you know, let's pull together something. And when we end up with one good, clean document that says the whole thing, then, you know, I'll put it together and put it on my website, and you can download it, and you can make as many copies as you want and send them out to folks, and we'll see what happens. But, yeah, I've got, you know, the things for my list for it. Kevin in Washington, D.C. on the line. Hey, Kevin, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. By the way, did you get the material I sent about the school lunches?
I got school lunch information from about a half a dozen people, Kevin, so
yeah,
in all probability, yes. Yes.
And
thank you.
Okay, yeah, I just wanted to make sure. One thing I wanted to point out, recently there's been a lot of stories in the news about how much indebted to China we are in this country.
Yes.
And you know, that really doesn't concern me. What I'm more concerned with is how much we're indebted to Saudi Arabia.
Our debt to the Saudis goes back to the 70s. You know?
Yeah, and one out of every $5 in this economy has a Saudi name attached to it. And this is something that the Bush family is very good at, because when the first Bush was in, we were blaming the Japanese.
Yeah. You know, over $1 billion has been transferred from Saudi Arabia and Saudi companies and the Bin Laden family to entities associated with the Bush family over the last 30 years.
Yeah. And I think the reason why they're so worried about China is probably because China's the only country that is capable of collecting on that debt right now.
Well, it's an unfortunate reality, and you pointed out well, Kevin, and I think it's one that really needs to be said, that if Saudi Arabia tomorrow, or if China tomorrow, if both of these countries hold enough of our debt, for that matter, South Korea or Japan tomorrow, I mean, there's a half a dozen, England, for that matter, there's probably eight or nine countries that hold enough of our debt that if tomorrow they said, we're just going to start dumping all our U.S. treasuries, it would throw our economy into a tailspin from which we would not quickly or easily recover. It would be worse than the Great Depression. And the Bush administration knows that, and that's why they're not taking on China. It's 40, and thanks for the call, Kevin. It's 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
1-800-933-2596 for free information. That's 1-800-933-2596. There's absolutely no obligation.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Yeah, it'd be nice to have some truth, wouldn't it? Yeah, welcome back. Tom Hartman here. Your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio, defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Our program today brought to you by MotorSilk, 1-866-LESS-FUEL. 1-866-LESS-FUEL, evergreenamerica.com. You can check it out. I'm going to go to your calls in just a minute, but first I just have to share a piece of audio that you can find at nocrony.com, N-O-C-R-O-N-Y.com. And this is Richard Land with the RNC. This was a secret conference call for members of the Republican National Committee. And this is Richard Land speaking about why Limbaugh and company should not be worried about Harriet Myers. Just listen to this. This is one of the most stunning things I've heard in a long, long time.
And this president, and he knows that Harriet Myers is also a Texan, and with a degree of understanding that would never have to be articulated, he and she both understand that if she were to get on the court and she were to rule in ways that are contrary to the way the president would want her to approach her role as a justice, it would be a deep personal betrayal and would be perceived as such both by him and by her. And he knows in nominating a woman who comes from outside the Beltway bubble, whose culture was formed in Texas, and who doesn't care what the New York Times thinks. She doesn't care. and he doesn't care, which is one reason why they've been successful conservatives. I think this is a brilliant nomination, and I think it'll be confirmed in the way she rules on cases that are very important to us over the next decade.
You get that? She is so loyal to George W. Bush that if she were to rule against him, it would be viewed as a personal betrayal of one Texan to another.
That if she were to get on the court and she were to rule in ways that are contrary to the way the president would want her to approach her role as a justice, it would be a deep personal betrayal and would be perceived as such both by him and by her.
This is incredible. He's saying she's going to be Bush's puppet. That's why she's being nominated. It's Bush's puppet. She's going to do whatever George Bush says, whatever George Bush wants. This is mind-blowing. Whatever Bush wants, whatever he says, we're going to give it to him. Don't worry. Harriet Meyer's going to do exactly what you say, George, and that's the beginning and end of it. Whatever George Bush says, he's going to get, because otherwise she would be betraying him in exchange for that nomination to the Supreme Court of the United States. This is absolutely mind-boggling. Ruth in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Ruth, welcome to the program.
Yes, I'd like your reaction to the CIA's Inspector General Porter Gross's statement that he would not release the findings of the independent report on the 9/11 attacks because it would be too demoralizing to the CIA.
Yeah, well, it's what can I say? I mean, obviously, there are professionals within the CIA who have a strong interest in making sure that the truth gets out there. I mean, just you know, an absolute strong interest in making sure that the truth gets out there. And there are other people who want their butt covered. And the butt coverers are, by and large, those people who are hanging out with Dick Cheney and Scooter Libby and the neocons and the real professionals, the ones who are saying, hey, there is no connection. You got no war here. There's nothing happened. Many of them have been driven out of the CIA by Porter Goss himself. So, you know, Porter Goss, a political hack, a hardcore Republican partisan, is now running the CIA. And when he says we're not going to release something for any reason, I mean, fill in the blank, but particularly an emotional reason, you just have to know, bottom line, it's nonsense. I mean, there's just no other way to say it. Dick on the line. Dick, I don't have a city for you. Where are you located?
Well, I'm in Seattle, Tom.
Okay, what's up, Dick?
Well, you know, I'm real concerned about these 9/11 commission apologists, especially the commissioners themselves. I mean, what Tim Romer doesn't tell you is that the commission members didn't do the work on the 9/11 investigation. It was organized by the executive director, Philip Zelikow, a Bush operative from way back to Bush 41, and he selected the staff members. He appointed them, and half of those had ties to the very agencies they were investigating. And most of the commission members had themselves conflicts of interest and shouldn't have been on that commission. And when he tells you they investigated the collapse of Building 7 in the World Trade Center, why isn't it listed in the report? And they don't go into any of the details about that. So I'd urge your listeners to get David Griffin's book, The 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions. And while I don't agree with all of it in there, there's information in there that shows that this 9/11 commission was nothing more than a cover-up report. And to give you an idea of how far out of touch Romer is, listen to what he says about the JFK assassination. He still thinks it was a lone nut and a magic bullet.
Well, actually, I thought maybe, you know, I'm sure he didn't mean it to sound that way, but he said whenever the government does something, there are conspiracies. He said they still think, you know, and then he talked about the conspiracy theories around Lincoln and Kennedy. And I almost interrupted him and said, wait a minute, you think the government killed Lincoln and Kennedy? It's like,
well, you know, it's pretty obvious.
I'm hearing a discussion in my headphones, Stan. You need to pot that thing down. Stan at Air America, please. Please grab that thing, whatever that is that's coming into my ear. Harry and
hello?
I'm just going to have to pot this down. Stan in New York City at Air America, if you're hearing me, I'm hearing another feed coming into my headphone right now. Okay, yeah, please do something about that right away. Harry in Seattle, you're on the line. What's up, Harry?
Hi. Okay, a few minutes ago you were talking about...
I think Harry's... Also hearing it. We got things all scrambled here.
About Building 7?
Okay. Here, I just, one more time. Richard Land, the RNC conference call.
And this president and... And he knows that Harriet Myers is also a Texan, and with a degree of understanding that would never have to be articulated, he and she both understand that if she were to get on the court and she were to rule in ways that are contrary to the way the president would want her to approach her role as a justice, it would be a deep personal betrayal and would be perceived as such both by him and by her. And he knows in nominating a woman who comes from outside the Beltway bubble, whose culture was formed in Texas, and who doesn't care what the New York Times thinks. She doesn't care, and he doesn't care, which is one reason why they've been successful conservatives. I think this is a brilliant...
Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast and border to border. Catherine DeBrack is with us. Catherine is the author of a new children's book, Help Mom, There Are Liberals Under My Bed. Hey, Catherine, welcome to the program. Catherine? I can't hear Catherine. Stan? we need to get Catherine DeBrack on, but maybe she's gone. I don't know.
Let's Tom, see. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you just fine.
I couldn't hear you before. How are you?
Oh, I'm great, and thank you very much for being on our program.
Sure.
Your book, Help Mom, There Are Liberals Under My Bed. I read the book. A couple of things that concern me about it that I'd like to talk with you about, if it's
sure.
All right. The first is... I remember back in the 19th century, in the 1800s in the United States, there were a lot of books that even children's books that portrayed blacks as having, you know, exaggerated lips and exaggerated sexuality and tendencies towards violence, and they drove a lot of hatred against blacks in the United States. I know in the 1930s in the United States there was a lot of literature. I've seen a fair amount of it. We actually put together we were researching a book on the religion of the Nazis and discovered that there was a lot of this going on actually in the United States, characterizing Jews as people who had big noses and you know these caricatures. And in your book, you portray the liberals, who basically the two that I see look like Teddy Kennedy and Hillary Clinton, as having alcoholic red cheeks and kind of snarly looks on their faces. Are you concerned that you're helping raise a generation of hateful children?
No. And my book doesn't really talk about that. I mean, it just talks about how liberals are silly. But, you know, I mean, I didn't have intentions of alcoholic red cheeks. I mean, Ted Kennedy usually does have rosy cheeks, so he was obviously that was a caricature of him in there just because that's the way he looks. And really, those pictures in there are really for the adult humor. You know, it's a children's book with a sweet story. But the caricatures and some of the adult humor in there is really for parents to enjoy reading it with their kids.
Okay. Yeah. For example, you see Mary Leach stood up big and tall in front of the camera. We liberals know how to take care of our children in those shoes. His red cheeks glowing on the screen.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. So you see that as he's just being friendly and healthy.
I just think he has his cheeks are red. I mean, would you rather me? I don't know what.
No,
you
I just. You know,
my
it just
God,
seemed to me that
the humor here. You're reading way too into the book.
Okay, well, it seemed to me that it was that it's really a caricature. I noticed in the main points that you make in the book are first of all that liberals are in favor of taking people's money via taxes. That seems to be a main theme. The kids, it's a great story about some kids who are putting up a lemonade stand, a marvelous thing. We all believe in capitalism and free enterprise, and want our kids to make lemonade. You know, it's a great way to start out. And the government comes and says, oh, you've got to pay taxes. I'm curious, George W. Bush and Ronald Reagan, between the two of them, have created the largest tax increase. Actually, both, you could take either one of them separately. Both Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush have increased taxes more than any other president in history. George W. Bush has increased taxes more than, with the exception of Ronald Reagan, all presidents since World War I. We have now a $7.5 trillion, pushing $8 trillion debt. The tax, of course, is not being paid by people right now who are paying taxes. It's going to be paid by our children. This year, we're paying $160 billion of our money, which is enough to hire, even at union wages, over a million teachers across the country. We're paying $160 billion just in interest,
okay,
just on the money that Ronald Reagan borrowed, so the next generation is paying it. If you're concerned about kids, why not point out that the real tax raisers are Reagan and Bush?
Tom, you're misinterpreting everything. My book does not talk about Democrat, Republican.
No, it talks about liberal and conservative. I understand that.
It talks about liberal and conservative. And obviously, as a conservative, I am not happy with a lot of the spending. I agree with that 100%. But my book is talking about taxes. It's not talking about spending and deficits. It's talking about taxes where, when people work hard and succeed and earn more money, they're punished more by higher taxes because liberals say, you know, oh, well, you earn more, so you have to pay more, even though they've worked very hard to get it and work very hard to keep their income. It's that all of a sudden, you know, just because somebody's successful, they have to be punished with higher taxes. That's the point of taxes in the book and how it affects people, especially the small businesses and the entrepreneurs in this country, how that affects their ability to stay in business and provide for their family.
Well, I understand that well. I've started 7 businesses. I've employed over 100 people,
sure,
in my life. These are very real issues of taxes and taxation and ones that we have to grapple with. But I'm just baffled by, you know, it seems to me that it's conservatives who are raising taxes, not liberals. Liberals are asking
for
balanced budgets.
You're talking about taxes, but you're...
In other words, you're saying, Catherine DeBrecht, that if a government spends money and borrows that money from the communist people of China, the Communist Republic of China, that's not a tax increase, that's never going to have to be paid back?
Tom, this is a kid's book that's talking about taxes over regulation and being offended by anything Christian. It's not talking about deficits, and as I've said, of course, I disagree as a true conservative with all the spending that has been done, okay? I don't mention Democrat and I don't mention Republican in my book. I talk about philosophies of conservatism.
Well, let's talk about the philosophy then.
And traditional family values of self-reliance, hard work, charity, and faith.
Which I salute. Which I absolutely salute. And in fact, I was a little baffled by, you know, the kids wanted to put up a picture of Jesus in their lemonade stand and the government came along and told them they can't do that. You know, I've run businesses that have religious icons in them. In fact, I had one business where we had prayer meetings. The government can't stop a business from doing that.
Well, they can obviously stop kids from saying the Pledge of Allegiance just because it says the phrase "under God" in California. I mean, that's just...
But that's not a business. That's our tax dollars and using the coercive power of government. I went door to door for Barry Goldwater in 1964. I'll tell you, Barry Goldwater's position on this was anytime, and this I believe is the true conservative position. Anytime the coercive power of government, the power to stick a gun in somebody's face and say, you must do this or we will kill you or put you in jail. Anytime the coercive power of government is involved or anytime our tax dollars are involved, we have to be very careful about imposing religious beliefs on people.
Tom, what is imposing if the kids stand up and say the Pledge of Allegiance? The children are not required to stand and say the Pledge of Allegiance. So who's holding the gun saying, you better say the Pledge of Allegiance and you better say under God? All I'm saying is it's ridiculous.
But that's not what you talked about in your book. What you talked about in your book was you said that a business who puts up a picture of Jesus gets shut down by government. And nobody is saying that.
They're on the sidewalk. Lemonade stand is on the sidewalk.
Yeah, and you could put up a lemonade stand on the sidewalk with a picture of Jesus. Anybody can. Why would you say that liberals are trying to stop that?
Because that's public property. It's just like you can't have the Ten Commandments in the courthouse, which I am wondering which commandment offends them. Do not kill or do not steal.
Well, if you want to talk about the Ten Commandments, I mean, do you really think that we should put people to death for disrespecting their parents?
Put people to death for disrespecting their parents.
It's what's called for in Leviticus. It's one of the Ten Commandments.
It's honor thy father and mother.
That's right. And if you disrespect your parents, you should be stoned to death.
I didn't see that on the tablets.
Go back and read Leviticus. It's in there. It's in Deuteronomy as well. But we digress. Back to taxes for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
The quote liberal.
Now, wait, Tom. Are we talking about taxes or are we talking about deficits?
Neither.
Because you
we're talking about taxes. I'll use your frame.
To them taxes.
Sure, I'll use your frame for a moment, and we'll talk about taxes. The liberal position on this, and this is the position that the first person to call himself a liberal was George Washington in the United States. He said, you know, I'm a liberal. I hope ever to see values of liberality in America. And, in fact, he was also the first president of the United States to call for a progressive taxation program. And Jefferson wrote at length about how people's first wants should never be taxed. That is the if you know the basic cost of housing and food and all those things, that there should be no tax on people until those first wants are met. And the liberal position on this has been ever since the founding of this country that those people who are earning beyond their basic needs are doing so because they're using the commons, because they're using the infrastructure of this nation. When I ran a business and I had 40 people working for me, the reason I was successful was because I had a court system which paid for with tax dollars that was enforcing my contracts, because I had public schools paid for with tax dollars that provided me with an educated workforce. Shouldn't I be paying a little more for the commons that I'm using to make so much more money?
Well, isn't everybody else using the commons as well? I mean,
not at the same level that I am. Somebody who only has one employer, or somebody who just has a job, isn't using the commons as much as I was with 40 employees. Shouldn't I pay more for that?
No, I think everybody should pay equally. And you know,
regardless of how much they're using.
I cannot understand how, if somebody's running a business and making very good money, how they would be using public transportation or any of that. Look, what it basically
they are. That's how their employees are getting to work.
Well,
you can't run a business without employees.
Oh, so the employer should be responsible.
Catherine, you want to continue this conversation?
We
got to take a break. Hang on, Catherine. Just hang on. We'll continue after this break, if you will.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
See how they explain the inexplicable. Watch them all debate the undebatable. Apparently.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We are talking with Catherine DeBrecht. Catherine is the author of Help, Mom, There Are Liberals Under My Bed, a new children's book that's become a bestseller and it's getting a lot of attention. And portrays liberals as, if I may say, Catherine, kind of nasty folks.
No, they're just silly. Tom, get a sense of humor. They're just silly.
Okay, as
and
silly
misguided.
Folks.
And misguided.
And misguided. Okay, we were talking about taxes, and you were explaining to me how if somebody is making $1 million a year, they're not making a greater use of the commons than somebody who's making $20,000 a year. Can you explain that to me?
I want to ask you a question about
sure.
this, because you said the employer is responsible for using the commons for his employees. Aren't these what happened to self-responsibility? Aren't these employees who are using the roads and stuff to go to work at this employer's place, aren't they responsible for themselves, or are you making the employer more responsible for himself and for all of his employees?
No, I didn't say the employers are responsible for the employees. What I
said
was
using the commons because these employees are using the roads to get to work every day.
Right, and I can't run a business.
Aren't those employees the ones responsible for themselves?
I can't run a business if my employees can't get to work.
And they can't have a job unless they make themselves go to work. I mean,
sure.
So I guess as an employer, boy, you'd be real great to work with. You'd drive around a school bus and pick everybody up.
No, that's not what I'm suggesting at all.
Work. I mean,
what?
If obviously if you feel they're not responsible and enough adults to be able to get to work on their own, I guess that's what you're...
No, Catherine, what I'm saying is, as an employer, I use the commons more heavily than any of my individual employees. The commons, not just the commons of the roads, but particularly, you know, if I'm shipping things, if I have, you know, a fleet of trucks out there or whatever, although a lot of that is actually paid for by, you know, gasoline taxes and things. I'm using the commons, the public commons of our infrastructure. The main commons, though, that I'm using is our court system. The vast majority of activity in our court system, more than 50% of all the activity in our court systems in the United States, has nothing to do with crime. It has to do with corporations enforcing contracts. contracts. And yet corporations are not paying 50% of the taxes in this country. It's down around 5-6%, down from about 40% during the Eisenhower administration when real conservatives were running this country. The other main part of the commons that I'm using is our financial system, a stable monetary system. Plus I'm using the commons of our laws, the laws that are in place that allow me to enforce contracts and that define the parameters of business. Those commons are things that I think it's important and appropriate that businesses pay for. But the larger question is, if somebody is making enough that 100% of their income is going to just the costs of life, then 100% of their income is coming in and going back out again. So they're also, that means 100% of their income they're basically paying sales tax on. They're paying, you know, national, federal, and state income taxes and those kinds of things. On the other hand, if somebody is making enough money that they can invest a large portion of it, or as with George Bush's most recent tax break, if you invest money and you make your living sitting on your butt around the pool waiting for the dividend checks to arrive, like, for example, the Walton family, then your maximum tax rate is only 15%. And yet those people are using the commons, you know, at least as much as I am. Shouldn't they at least pay the same percentage as me?
Have a flat tax, same percentage. But see, here's your thing. You're saying, as an employer...
But we don't. The conservative position is let...
Are you going to let me talk? Are you going to... Listen,
go for it.
You said, as an employer, you use the commons more. But isn't an employer one that provides products and services in this country, provides jobs and benefits in this country?
No.
Oh, they don't. They don't
no.
provide the products in this. Well, what do they do?
No, you need to invert your frame, Catherine.
They don't
Catherine.
Provide a product. Then I guess these manufacturing things don't pump anything out. And
Catherine DeBrecht, you're operating under the assumption that as an employer, I'm providing a job to an employee. That's not the case. My employee is providing me with a product or service, their labor or their time or their intellect or their brawn, on which I can make a profit.
Wait.
The only reason that I will hire somebody is if I can make more money from them than they cost me.
Well, Tom, don't you think it's an equal thing?
No, it's not an equal thing. If it's an equal thing, then you don't have profit. And why have business if you can't have profit?
Well, of course. It's what business would even survive if they didn't want to make a profit?
That's right.
I'm
all in favor of profit. I'm all in favor of profit. But what I'm saying is that when people say, and this is one of the great myths in America right now that's been promulgated, you know, largely since Reagan came along, that employers give people jobs. Employers don't give people jobs. Employers have things that need to be done in order to manufacture goods or services that they can sell for a profit, and those things need to be done by people. And the only terms under which they will hire people is if they can make more money than those people cost them. So it's not that employers are giving people jobs, it's that employers are using the labor of people.
Well, then why all the screaming by the left when a company picks up and moves across seas and they complain that they're not getting their jobs, that they're losing their jobs? They should say,
well,
no, we're here to provide a service.
I think that screaming is happening all across America, left, right, and middle. Nobody, you know, I think a whole lot of us are saying, hey, you know, this is America. We're Americans. We think that American jobs should stay here with Americans. You disagree with that? You think it's just fine for American jobs to go to China and India?
No, I think businesses are so overregulated and overtaxed that they wind up going somewhere else. And it's funny because you hear the left talk about how evil businesses are. Oh, businesses are the
I'm not talking
things.
About that. And
no,
I and
minute.
I don't hear the left talking about
are you
that.
Kidding? Let me talk. I'm saying you hear on the left all the time how evil businesses are.
No, you
but
don't.
But then when they pick up and move out of the country, they get mad.
No, I'm sorry, Catherine. You don't hear the left talking about how evil businesses are. You hear conservatives talking to each other about how the left says that. That's the whole point. That's my concern about your book, is that it's a caricature. It doesn't reflect reality. But, you know, you made your points very well, and I appreciate your coming on, Catherine. It was a good and lively conversation. People can read the book and make some money for you and make up their own mind. The book is Help, Mom, There Are Liberals Under My Bed. Catherine DeBrecht, I appreciate you being with us. 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM. 440-TOM. Truth and common sense in broadcasting for a change. It's time for our, at the end of the week here, last day of the week, get a couple folks on who are out there in the in the blogosphere and in the real world, tracking down real stories and finding out what's going on. And look over the best of the rest of the news. We have with us Lowell Finley, an attorney at law at Berkeley, California, voting rights activist with Voter Action. And we have Doug Cunningham. Doug is a reporter and anchor for Workers Independent News, which we play on this program. Doug's website is laborradio.org. Lowell's is voteraction.org. Hey, Doug.
Hi, Tom. Glad to be back on with you.
Great to have you here. And Lowell, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Great to have you here as well. Both of you, I want to ask each of you a couple of quick questions, and then we've got some callers here. I'd like to take some calls and some of the topics of the day, and some folks I know are responding to the guests that I just had, and leave you guys on with us, and you can kind of chime in and offer your 2 cents worth. Is that all right with you guys?
Yeah, sure. Sounds good.
Sounds like a plan. Okay. First of all, broadly speaking, Lowell, voter action, voting rights activists, what do you see as the biggest news of this week in overall and particularly in the context of voting rights?
Well, I'm working with two attorneys in New Mexico on a lawsuit for 8 New Mexico voters challenging future use of voting machines that failed and were inaccurate in last year's general election. And we've been conducting discovery. We've taken more than 7 depositions now, and we're turning up some really disturbing evidence. First of all, touchscreen voting machines that switch people's votes repeatedly when they try to vote for a Democrat for Congress, the machine repeatedly switches their vote to the Republican candidate.
These don't happen randomly? They don't just flip back? It's always in favor of the Republicans?
Most of the reports. There have been isolated reports of it going the other way. But for that to happen in anybody's favor or to anyone's disadvantage is a serious problem for our election system.
Sure, although you could argue, it's just a glitch if it's 50-50. But if it's not 50-50, then you got to really start scratching your head.
Yeah, we're very concerned that there is a pattern here. And the same thing is true with other types of voting machines that were used in New Mexico. There's a very clear pattern that New Mexico not only has the highest rate of undervotes in the country, that is, people who cast a ballot but appear not to have voted for president, but that particularly is high for Hispanic voters in the state and Native American voters in the state, and both of those groups vote overwhelmingly Democratic.
Lowell Finley, I heard recently that in the state of New Mexico that if you just counted the votes of people who voted on paper, that Al Gore won with a significant margin. But if you just counted the votes on the electronic voting machines, that George Bush won by a considerable margin. What would account for that difference? Is that difference real, first of all?
Yes. That fits with our data, and we've had experts analyze the official data 7 ways from Sunday, and that certainly fits. The explanations range from the fact that you get these very high undervote rates on the paperless touchscreen machines, and the votes that are being lost or missed seem to be coming from Democratic precincts. And in the other direction, you have a phenomenon of phantom votes, that is, where more votes get counted by a machine than there were voters. And those are showing up primarily in Republican precincts. Give you an example. Last year in November, in the voting in Albuquerque, New Mexico's largest city, the 10 precincts that had the highest rate of undervotes, that is, presidential votes missed somehow, were Democratic and heavily Hispanic. The 10 precincts that had the highest number of phantom votes, more votes than voters, were heavily Republican and white.
And did all those votes get counted?
All of the phantom votes got counted.
Wow. Okay. Lowell Finley, an attorney at law in Berkeley. Doug Cunningham, news reporter and anchor with the National Workers Independent News. Doug, what in your world was the big story this week?
Well, we follow, obviously, news of workers, their unions, and what happens with their issues. And a couple of big victories for workers in the past couple of weeks, in the past week, actually. Boeing workers won their strike at that large aircraft manufacturer, and they won it with no increases in health care costs to workers. They got their pensions increased, both defined defined benefit pensions and a defined contribution pension sweetener. They also got cost of living adjustments and bonuses of $10,000 over the life of the contract. So a successful strike by workers there that shows that unions and workers, even in this very hostile environment, can still pull off a victory now and then. Also, Kaiser Permanente, the biggest HMO in the United States, announced a huge labor management partnership agreement that runs for 5 years. That's an excellent model for labor management relations in other industries. It's a race to the top rather than a race to the bottom, with significant increases in wages and benefits, maintaining quality and still reaching some cost savings. And there are 82,000 workers involved there. So two big victories for workers in an era when, the climate overall is very hostile to organized labor. So it's good news to be able to report a couple of big stories like that that are important for workers and working families.
Great news, Doug. It's interesting how these things are shaking out. Speaking at the voting rights conference this last weekend, Earl Blumenauer showed up and a whole bunch of other folks, and these are really hot topics, both voting rights and the mind-boggling fact that all across America, newspapers that used to have labor pages now just have nothing but business news pages. Let's take a few phone calls here. Barbara in Seattle, Washington on the line. You're live with us. Hey, Barbara, what's up?
Hi. Well, I was actually called to make a comment about Catherine, the lady who had written that book.
That's fine.
And
It's Friday.
I found it very worrisome, just sort of what you were talking about, this vilification of the so-called liberals. She went on to say that it was such a funny thing in her mind and how serious we were making it. But, that's the whole thing of caricatures about people. And I really find that worrisome. I mean, here she said she wasn't being partisan, but then she had, caricatures of definitely Ted Kennedy, Democrats.
And Hillary Clinton.
And liberals. But,
yeah.
Oh, no, it's not partisan. And it's just misplaced. She's really unaware. I mean, I happen to own a business with my husband, and we have employees. And I just think the whole respect nowadays that it's all, the business and the owners, which we are. I mean, you have to respect your employees. And whatever happened to the idea about giving back to society that, has allowed you to be successful?
Well, that's the idea of the social contract, Barbara, and that's the problem.
Yeah.
Conservatives, by and large, don't believe in the social contract. Thank you for sharing your thoughts with us. I appreciate it. Doug, I suppose that's more your take on it. The point that I made in this discussion was that employers don't create jobs, that employers hire people because they want to make use of their labor or their minds, and they want to do so at a profit, that really we need to flip the paradigm around in this country back to where it was in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s before the conservative think tanks got a hold of it.
Well, I tell you, if we're gonna have the American dream survive for another generation or two, we absolutely have to turn it back to that paradigm, because we have to understand that employers have to realize that it's in their best interest in the long run, and in the nation's best interest in the long run, to create situations where workers' work is actually rewarded, and people can raise middle class families on the salaries, and that the benefits are there. If not, if we're just continually chasing that lower wage that we find across the globe, we're gonna kill the American dream, because ultimately there won't be enough people left in America with good enough jobs to be able to afford the American dream.
Yeah, well said, Anthony in Grand Rapids, Michigan. You're live with Doug Lowell and me. Hey, Anthony.
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Great, what's up?
Hey, man, just an analogy. I feel like I'm a Detroit Lion offensive man playing under Joey Harrington, and how I relate that is I feel like I'm an American citizen under poor leadership, and I've done everything that I can possible. I've called my Senator Carl Levins when it was had to do with that Non-Nuclear Proliferation Act.
Mm-hmm.
I called on John Roberts, and no matter what I keep doing, and nothing's happening. I mean, it seems like we're losing the battle.
Well, there's a lot of battles being fought, and some of them we're winning. But by and large, first of all, you said that you're calling our leaders. They're really our representatives. We don't elect leaders in this country. We elect people to represent us.
Okay, well, represent. Yeah.
Yeah. But, I'm sounding like the word police here. The point, though, I think there's a larger frame here, and that is that we need to hold our representatives accountable as representatives. But your larger question sounds like what you're saying, and tell me if I'm wrong, is, what can I do, right?
Here's the thing, Tom, is that, I just had to cut my health insurance just so I can save money. And I'm going back to school so that I can get another degree, because I can't find a degree under exercise or a job under exercise science, And so now I'm going back so that I can get a better job, hopefully, so that I can become rich and just join this. If you can't beat them, you might as well just join them. And, you know, that sounds selfish, but that's the
Well, there's nothing wrong with having a good job, Anthony. There's nothing
right.
wrong with having a good job. But the fact is that, you know, having to cut your health insurance. I think it's nuts that anybody should have to fight for health insurance in this country. I believe that it's a basic right, that we should all have health insurance, that Medicare should be a national program, that everybody should be included in it, like in every other industrialized country in the world, even the conservative industrialized countries like Great Britain. Anthony, thanks for the call. I mean, you just got to keep fighting. You got to keep speaking out and speaking up and getting out there. And by the way, show up for the Green Party, the Democratic Party, the Republican Party meetings, whichever one you're inclined to join, and participate. Go to those boring county meetings. Duggan and Lowell will be back with you guys and the rest of our callers right after this. It's 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back.
Yes, me friend.
Oh, me friends. Welcome back. 50 minutes past the hour, 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We're talking with Doug Cunningham. Doug with Workers Independent News, laborradio.org, their website, and Lowell Finley, an attorney in Berkeley, who's with voteraction.org. And Lowell, the last caller, was raising the issue of, you know, why even try if you don't think your vote's going to be counted? This is one of the general despair out there that so many people have. That's a really scary thing for democracy. How do you handle that?
Well, keep fighting, like you said. We've focused on New Mexico because we think it's a great small state in which we can come up with the hard evidence to show that there really are serious problems with electronic voting, and our country needs to steer away from that. But there are people all over the country working on this issue. There was just a big conference in Portland last week. There was a conference earlier this year in Nashville. People everywhere are working on trying to make sure that the way we select our representatives is fair, and that it's as tamper-proof as it can be. And I think that's an important first step. If somebody's not in a position to be in a union striking successfully, and it's great to hear that kind of news, at least you can get out there and work on making sure that our electoral system is fair so representatives truly represent us.
Yeah, I spoke at that conference in Portland this last weekend. It was a good one. And in my opinion, the big issue here is not just the privatization of the vote, which is, in my opinion, a felony against democracy, but the profiteering from the vote. We've got, you know, largely Republican-run corporations who are making millions, hundreds of billions of dollars, have a set aside almost $4 billion, as I recall, to go to, you know, for-profit corporations who are privatizing our vote. I mean, this is wrong.
Yeah, I agree. And at the other end of the process, there's a huge amount of money at stake. One of the things we found that was very disturbing in a deposition last week, we talked to a web developer who designed New Mexico's system for collecting their electronic voting results. And I asked him what kind of security he built into that system. And he says, well, it's good enough for what a bank would want for small amount transactions, but certainly not for transferring $1 million. And I listened to that, and I said, aren't our votes, isn't it the accuracy of the outcome of our elections worth $1 million?
Or trillions. I mean, that's the federal,
yeah,
you know, expenditures. That's incredible. Lowell Finley, or excuse me, Doug Cunningham, your take on the previous caller's comment about having to cut back on his health insurance. What are workers doing about this?
Health insurance is probably the biggest issue around the country now. Whenever unions go to collectively bargain with their employers, health care and the cost of health care are just huge. Delphi, the largest auto parts supplier in America, and General Motors are both dealing with huge health care costs and issues, trying to pass those costs on to workers. The union there trying to defend it. It's tough, you know. I, I don't know that there is a good solution right now. The long-term solution, of course, would be a national health care plan like the UAW wants to see, which would take care of all Americans, and it would be a national single-payer health care system like the ones used over in Europe and in other industrialized nations around the world. That's the long-term solution. Short-term, workers are in a real pinch, a real bind, and it's terrible. And I don't have any, unfortunately, any suggestions that can help people who are immediately faced with loss of their health insurance. Millions of people are going uninsured.
Yeah, and we all need to be speaking out and getting politically active. I mean, that's the bottom line. It's all about politics. So Adam in Westfield, New Jersey, you're on the line with us. Hey, Adam, what's up?
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Can you hear me?
I can.
How's that? Is that better?
Yeah, all of it is just fine.
What's that?
It's just fine. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just wondering, well, probably you haven't seen it because you've been on the air, obviously, but I was watching MSNBC a couple minutes ago, and they were just, the reporter seemed amazed. He said, they're voting on this energy bill, and there's a certain part where, you know, the government is going to relax rules of some kind of something or other.
Oh, yeah, these guys are finally, oh, we got a hurricane. Now we can relax the environmental rules.
Yeah, but he said, but the Democrats have 15 or 16 Republicans, and it looks like they're going to kill the bill. And I thought, what? And I jumped up and turned C-SPAN on, and they totally hijacked the vote. The Democrats were winning the vote. The time had run out. They kept it open for like another half hour until they squeezed two Republicans to switch to the other side, and they immediately closed the vote.
Oh, jeez. So this is terrible. Adam, thanks for the heads up. I mean, this is what Bernie Sanders is just constantly complaining about, and rightfully so, or pointing out. I shouldn't say complaining about, is that these guys, if the rules don't work for them, they change the rules. And this is just a horrible thing. Doug or Lowell, thoughts on those? And by the way, I'm curious, Doug, what do you see in just a few sentences as the biggest stories coming up next week?
Well, we can always hope for another criminal indictment of Tom DeLay. That might another criminal
or Karl Rove.
You know, maybe that'll happen. Or you know, and Harriet Myers, of course, we're going to hear more about her and from her. And her law firm, her former law firm, by the way, was involved in union busting consultancy. I don't know if she personally was involved in that. Her law firm.
Yeah, we shouldn't be surprised. And Lowell Finney, what do you see as the big news coming up next week?
Well, in my area,
Finley, excuse me.
There's a fight going on in Congress over meaningful versus cynical, you know, substitute bills to get a requirement nationally for verified paper ballots on touchscreen voting machines. A House of Representatives member from Florida named Feeney has introduced a bill that's just outrageous.
This is the same Tom Feeney who is alleged to have hired Clint Curtis to write vote hacking software for him when he was the Speaker of the House in Florida?
That's the guy. I think it's going to be important that that bill be, you know, shown up for what it is, and that people focus on trying to support H.R. 550, which is
Rush Holt's bill.
Rush Holt's bill, which is the best out there. And then from my point of view, we're charging ahead in New Mexico. Next week and in the weeks to come, we're going to be trying to put together more and more hard evidence of the fact that electronic voting is dangerous, it's inaccurate, it's subject to tampering, and we've got to move our country away from that.
There you go. Well said. Thank you so much for being with us. Lowell Finley, voteraction.org. Doug Cunningham, laborradio.org. I appreciate you both being with us today. Good on you. Good work. And thanks especially to Louise, to David Poole for producing our program, Shelby and Ben for streaming it at radiopower.org and whiterosesociety.org. Dan and Stan over at Air America Radio for running the board and catching the phones. Mike Toth for our archives.